Thank you so much, Rabbi Resnick. It really is a privilege to be back with you again. Thank you, Vivian. And it is a joy to share the Bima with Mimi and Bernie. Mazel tov. I mean, we have many more simchas together. So of your 68 years, I've been around for 55, and I look forward to celebrating many, many more years in the future. So as Rabbi Resnick said, the subject that I'm here to talk to you about today is a Jewish response to anti-Semitism. What is the best revenge? Anti-Semitism, I don't need to tell you that it's sort of an issue we're all thinking about today. The AJC just conducted a landmark survey of American Jews, and they found that 9 out of 10 American Jews feel like this is a problem for us here in the United States, and 8 out of 10 feel like it's getting worse. So you might say to yourself, well, that's here in America, but maybe we're blowing things out of proportion, the politics of today. But Tel Aviv University actually conducted a survey, and they found that globally around the world, anti-Semitic incidents are up by 13%. So again, we all want to distance ourselves and think, maybe it doesn't affect me. How about here in Florida? Well, the ADL, if you go to their website, they've conducted a map of the entire United States, but you can go online and click in Florida, including West Palm Beach, Boynton Beach, Boca, wherever, whatever community you may come from, and see how many incidents there have been in your community. And I can tell you that here in the state of Florida, you've had 142 separate anti-Semitic incidents against your people. It's not the kind of thing. Last year I came and spoke to you about Israel, about military threats. Anti-Semitism is the one thing that you can't escape, right? It's not about what you do. It's not about where you are. It's who you are. So I was trying to figure out somebody I could quote to open up my talk today, and every day there are politicians talking about anti-Semitism. It's easy. Yesterday, Mike Bloomberg was talking about anti-Semitism in politics on both the right and the left. And the day before that, the Congressional House Majority Leader, Steny Hoyer, he was talking about anti-Semitism and BDS. And as I was flicking through all these political leaders, I came across somebody else, another Jewish voice, Barbara Streisand. And actually, I feel like she put it best. So let me tell you what she said about anti-Semitism. She said, anti-Semitism is one of the most vexing, terrifying issues of our times. But, and this is what I appreciate, she gave it some context. She said, this anger and this hatred actually has been here 3,500 years. It just reveals itself in different ways through the millennia. Jews have always been scapegoats, blamed for the ills of the world. And then Barbara Streisand said, I'm not articulate enough to say how to end it or to show you the way. But I would argue that Barbara Streisand actually did show me the way when, as Rabbi Resnick alluded to, I was forced to confront what the ADL calls heat. It's a heat map. Hate, extremism, anti-Semitism, and terrorism, right? The heat that follows you as a Jew. Hate, extremism, anti-Semitism, and terrorism. Barbara Streisand, through her character of Yentl, if you saw that movie, do you remember when she dressed up? Yes, I see heads nodding. As a yeshiva boy, we'll get to this later, helped me find the way as I tried to answer that question, what is the best revenge? What is the antidote to anti-Semitism? What is anti-Semitism? I'm going to take you through my story, and my goal for this morning, I am going to look at my watch. Don't want to overstay my welcome. But my goal is that each and every one of you walks out of here saying, now I know what to do. Now I personally know what to do as I confront this challenge of today. I now know what the best revenge, what my response as a Jew is to anti-Semitism. And I'm going to do that by sharing my story with you. So my story literally starts with a bang. I was a college student, an English major, lost in Shakespeare, at Harvard, and one Friday evening, I got a phone call, and it was my father. He was calling from Israel. He was in Israel as a tourist. And he said, Laura, I'm alive. And that was sort of a shock to me. I said, what do you mean? And he said, for those of you who know the story, he said, the news is reporting that a rabbi from New York has been shot in the head and killed by a terrorist, but I just want you to know that I'm okay. I'm in the hospital, but I survived. And he started to explain to me what happened. He was walking back from the Kotel. Have you been to the Old City on a Friday evening? He had been to the services, and he was walking through the Old City, through the marketplace, David Street, you know, that main corridor that walks, you walk past the various shopkeepers, and someone was in an alley crouching and saw his kippah and aimed right for the kippah, right for his head, and fired a bullet right at his head. When the police found the gun, it was a Beretta, it was hot. And then he was taken away to the hospital where he survived the shooting. I was a young person. I had grown up on Long Island after the Holocaust at a time of optimism and joy, and we were in America. But there was always this crouching fear, right? I understood that what happened to my father, what was crouching in that dark alleyway and had reached out to shoot him, it was something bigger than just my father being shot in the head. It took away my innocence, but it was something that I always suspected existed out there. What was this thing? It was the ability to take away the humanity of Jews. What makes it so easy to kill Jews? Again, the hate, extremism, anti-Semitism, and terrorism. It's something larger. It's not an isolated event. And I understood that none of us sitting here are safe, even as a young person. As I said, I was an English major. And Seamus Heaney, I don't know if you've heard of him, the famous Irish poet, he was my professor. I was in a poetry writing seminar, and he said, write about something that happened to you this week, students. So here's the poem that I wrote the week that my father was shot. If you saw him walking through the twisted canals of the Arab market last Friday night, if you are the one who watched his white yarmulke glide along black stone alleys winding home from the Western Wall, if you are the man who marked his head float past the spice man, the rug dealer, the butcher closing their shops, if you are the Arab who aimed in the near dark, grazing his temple, missing his life, this hand will find you. I am his daughter. I know it wasn't a great poem. I actually got a B+. And I kind of put it away where we all put all of our revenge fantasies, right? It's the kind of thing you wake up in the middle of the night, ooh, I'm going to get even for that. But you get on with your life. And I became a reporter at the Washington Post. I covered a lot of revenge in Northern Ireland between Catholics and Protestants, on Capitol Hill between Democrats and Republicans. But it was time for me to get married. My husband said, let's take a honeymoon year in Israel. And I decided before I was ready to start my new family, there was some old business that I had to settle. I needed to settle a score for my old family, for my father. And so I took a leave of absence from the Washington Post, and I started digging into the records. Who was this? What was this crouching evil that we all kind of feel almost like a prickling on the back of our neck? Who was this person who had tried to kill my father and nearly took him away from me forever? And I had a list of names of some suspects, some Palestinians who had been part of a gang, a very radical faction, breakaway, backed by Syria, breakaway faction from the PLO. And by myself, again, I was on my own, I wasn't with the Washington Post, I was on leave, I told everyone I was writing a book about revenge. And I took this list of names and I started going house to house. There's no street addresses in the West Bank. It was a village really on the edge of civilization, outside of Ramallah. I ended up in the last street, in the last house, overlooking a ravine, and I knocked on a door. And I said, is Omar there? Because he was one of the names on the list. And the mother swung open the door and she said, oh, come on in. Yes, here's Omar. He's right up there. There's his picture on the wall. And I said, well, where is he? They said, oh, well, the Israelis arrested him. What did he do? He tried to kill someone. Who? And there was a 12-year-old boy who had come in. The family was coming in to join me on the couch. And the 12-year-old boy looked at me and said, some Jew. And I said, well, why did he try to kill him? He said, I don't know. He must have been doing something bad. He was a Jew. And I sat down on the couch, and they started to tell me as the family kind of drifted in. It was a hot July afternoon. They kept handing me glasses of cold orange juice and hot tea and describing what had happened that day. They said there was a man walking through the marketplace, and Omar saw him with a kippah, and he fired at his head, and then he ran away. He must have been doing something bad. And I said to the gunman's brother, I said, but aren't you afraid that someone will ever want to get revenge? He said, no, it was nothing personal. There's no revenge. He did it so people would look at us, to bring attention to our people. We sat for 4 hours as they talked about their pride. The mother at one point reached over and kind of slapped my knee like, isn't this great? We're all standing up. We're all doing what we need to do. And again, I swallowed the hot tea and I swallowed the heat and I swallowed the pain. And they said to me, nothing personal, no revenge. As I walked away, I turned around one more time to look at them. They all gathered. There were about 15 relatives on the stairs waving at me. They were lovely people other than wanting my father dead and being proud of it. Omar had been taken away. He was in prison. He was their hero. And I asked myself that basic question that I'm also posing to you today. What is the response? How does a Jew respond to that? What is the best revenge? I had two competing impulses. One of them was Rambo, right? I was going to be Sylvester Stallone. I was just going to grab him, or maybe Gal Gadot, Wonder Woman, and just be a superhero. But I knew that wasn't realistic. You look at me, you can see why that wasn't realistic. The other idea was another fantasy that was equally far out. The idea was I was going to find the shooter and force him to confront the humanity of his victim and the inhumanity of terrorism. For me, it all came down, and it goes right back to the Holocaust, even though I wasn't born at the time of the Holocaust. It's the dehumanization that made it easy. So my idea was to reach down, not physically to grab him, but to reach down into his soul and shake him up and make him confront the inhumanity of what he had done. But how could I possibly do that? I decided to take lessons in revenge. So the first person I went to was, of course, the head of the Mossad, since they're good at that. And the chief of the Mossad, again, I was just a journalist writing a book about revenge. I didn't say I had a personal vendetta. He said to me, this is what we do in the Mossad. When you're seeking retaliation, you choose the battlefield, you choose the method, and you choose the timing. You wait for your moment. So I set out for a year, and I went around the world to refine my methods, to figure out what I was going to do. I started off in the obvious place, Sicily, right? Cradle of the vendetta. And it was a pleasure, I have to say, to go to Sicily, where everybody loved revenge. And because when I talked to people in America, they thought I was crazy. So, and nobody wanted to talk about revenge. So I came to Sicily, and even the clergy were like, of course you have to get revenge. You're a coward. You're a fool. You're a woman if you don't get revenge. And I interviewed the mayor of Palermo. And I said to him, I was walking through his mansion into the foyer, and I said to him, excuse me, Mr. Mayor, what are the rules? I'm trying to figure out the rules of revenge. And he looked at me like I was this funny person who had gotten off in the wrong airport. He said, what are the rules? He said, in Sicily, there's one rule, utter and complete financial and physical destruction. Here we have no limits. So then I got back on the plane, and I went to Albania, where they have rules. In fact, I don't know if has anyone been to Albania. They have something called the Kanun. It was written in the 15th century. It's a 200-page book listing all the rules of revenge. And if you walk into somebody's home, they might have it in their kitchen drawer like your takeout menus. You know, they've got these menus for revenge and what you can do, what you can't do. When you walk on the sidewalk, two men, they always have to make sure to stand one rifle butt apart. Because if you bang into somebody, right, that's going to start a whole revenge feud. You have to be really careful. I traveled to the north to a village. Each village has a blood feud committee. And I sat with the blood feud committee, and I asked Mark, who was actually the head of the blood feud committee, what kind of revenge would be appropriate if somebody was shot in the head. And as I was sitting there, I was looking around, and I noticed there were Christian icons all around the room, that there were Christians in Albania. And I said to Mark, the chairman of the Blood Feud Committee, how does this revenge culture fit in with the Christian idea of turn the other cheek? And Mark talked to his colleagues for a minute. He goes, we have a saying like this in Albania. Don't touch my cheek. I'll kill you. So in Albania, it was a fully integrated part of their society. The next place I went to was a country where there was no pretenses of separating justice. You know, in the United States, we have justice system, and then there's revenge, which is wild justice. I went to Iran. The Islamic Republic of Iran weaves revenge and justice together. If you go to court, let's say, God forbid, your brother was killed. So the judge will decide whether the killer is, you know, guilty or innocent. If he decides that the defendant is guilty, it's not up to the judge to give the sentencing. It's up to the family. So the defendant comes in front of the family and he'll beg and he'll say, "I'm sorry for killing your brother." And the defendant gets to decide. I'm sorry. The victim's family gets to decide whether they're going to take revenge on the killer or not. And they say, "Please, on the name of Allah, on the name of Muhammad." And the judge said, "God," it gets really loud in our courtrooms because everyone's wailing and crying and begging. And the family gets to decide, "I don't forgive you. I don't forgive you." Three times. If they say, "I don't forgive you," the third time, the killer is executed and the family has a prerogative to walk over and pull out the chair. They actually get to take revenge because they acknowledge that there is no difference between revenge and justice. When I was in Iran, I decided I wanted to know specifically what would be the right response, though, for the injury that had been rendered to my father. So, you know the hijab, right? That's the black robe. So I wore a hijab in Tehran, but then I decided I wanted to go to the village or the city where Ayatollah Khomeini was from, Qom. In order to go to Qom, you have to wear a chador on top of a hijab. So there's this extra layer of black robe. I drove south from Tehran, and my translator, as we were going south towards this village filled with the seminaries of Islam, she said, "Get down in your seat. You're not really supposed to be as a non-Muslim coming into this town." And when we got to the checkpoint, she said, "Pretend you're sleeping." So I had this chador over me and a hijab and one eye looking out. And just as we were going through the checkpoint, she pushed me down one more time. I was like a pile of dry cleaning, just like black heap on there, going into the city of Qom. And I managed to make my way in and interview the Grand Ayatollah of Iran. First, he took my camera away and he stood me up against the wall. I wasn't sure what this was about. It was before selfies, but he took my camera and he took my picture. And I asked why, and he said, "Because if it was a gun, we would shoot you," because they weren't sure, you know, they're the security. And then I started talking to him about, I actually asked him, if a Palestinian shot a Jew in Jerusalem, again, I can't believe I had the chutzpah to do this. My daughter is here. Please don't try this at home. Okay. I don't know how I had the chutzpah to do this. This is what you do before you have children. He said to me, "In fact, we have blood money. And even though the Jew was coming in peace," he said, "as long as it wasn't a Zionist," he said, the Palestinian would owe him blood money, which we pay in camels. And since he didn't die, but he was injured, it would be about 1/9 of one camel, which I figured would be like one fur glove and a hoof or something. And he said, "Or you could shoot the shooter, but you had to shoot him exactly with the same degree of injury that he shot your father. Otherwise, he can shoot you back." Again, all of this seemed completely outside of reality and what I wanted to do. What I kept doing again and again as I was searching for the etiquette of revenge is coming back to that family. Because to me, that was the core. That was the essence. I would sit with them week after week, the family of the shooter. Lovely people in every way, as I said, except for being proud and feeling no remorse over what they had done to my father and supporting their son and their brother in the shooting. And I would look into their eyes and I would ask myself, could I make my father human in the gunman's eyes? Could I make him a real person? And there was a little bit of Queen Esther in me, you know, I grew up with all these Bible stories and thinking, they don't know that I'm Jewish. They actually assumed that I was Christian. On Christmas, they wished me, you know, Merry Christmas. They baked me cookies for Easter. They're Muslim, but they gave me Easter cookies, and I like joked to myself that I should never be in profile because they'll know I'm Jewish. That was my joke to myself. And I was terrified. My hands were shaking. They offered to convey letters between me and the shooter back and forth. He was in prison, and they said, "We'll sneak them into prison." So here is actually one of the letters so that I could communicate with him. You can see, I'm just going to crackle it in front of the microphone. It was written on tissue paper, and Omar the gunman would fold it into tiny little pieces and put it under his tongue in a plastic, like he would seal it in plastic, spit it through the chicken wire, when the brothers would visit him in jail, and that was how, and then I would unwrap it and read a letter from him. And I thought, maybe this way I can communicate my father's humanity, never saying that I'm the daughter, of course, just that I'm a journalist, I'm interested in revenge. Well, his letters came back, and there were these terrorist ideological screeds. I am proud to have fired on the chosen military target. He was describing my father as a military target. And it was very, very depressing to me that he seemed to be, again, completely proud of and dug into what he was doing. And in the meantime, the family kept getting closer and closer to me. Laura, Laura, Laura is visiting. They never asked for my last name. They never really asked what I was doing beyond writing a book about revenge, but, you know, in the Middle East, that doesn't seem that unusual. When their daughter was pregnant, they looked at me and they said, you know, if she has a boy, we'll name her after Grandpa, Imad. But if she has a girl, we're going to name her Laura. Again, this horrible feeling all the time of tension, of pain, of confusion, and that question, what is the best revenge? I considered collective revenge. Do you just take revenge against all of them? I thought about divine vengeance. Maybe you leave it to God, right? We all think about divine vengeance when we say, why do good people go unrewarded and bad people unpunished, right? God will get them later. God will even it up. Sometimes the offense is so big you feel like, I can't take revenge. I'm just going to leave it up to God. And I'll tell you who told me the most honest answer with that. It was the widow of the late Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. I went to her home 2 weeks after her husband was assassinated, if you remember. And I said to her, I was interviewing her for the Washington Post, I said, Leah, how much revenge for what happened to your husband? And she looked at me, I'll never forget Leah Rabin, her green eyes were hard as marbles. And she said, none. There is not enough revenge in the world. So that's divine vengeance. My father, who kind of knew what I was doing, mostly didn't, after I didn't tell him I went to Iran until after I got back, he would kind of weigh in occasionally and say, Laura, constructive revenge. That's the best revenge. You should say that the best way to get even is through constructive revenge. What did he mean by that? That you change the power imbalance, right? When you're hurt and you feel like wounded, you want to strike the other person. Build yourself up. Don't blow yourself up, right? The suicide bombers, they blow themselves up to get revenge. Jews, they build themselves up. And he kept telling me about this great example of constructive revenge at the Kotel. But the problem was, it wasn't on the women's side of the Kotel, it was on the men's side. Here comes Yentl. So Rabbi Resnick mentioned my father-in-law and his Orthodox minion. I borrowed my father-in-law's Orthodox hat, you know, the black hat, and his trench coat. And my father brought me into the men's section of the Kotel. Sorry, Dad, I'm revealing that. Into the men's section of the Kotel. For those of you who've been there, you know how there's a tunnel, and you go inside, and there's kind of a domed study hall. My father brought me into the men's section, and he pointed up at the ceiling and said, there it is. There were tall black letters nailed onto the wall inside the Kotel, and there was a quote from Deuteronomy 32. O nations, acclaim his people, for God will avenge the blood of his servants and render vengeance on his foes. Now, under that quote from the Tanakh, men were seated at table studying Talmud. Their shadows were bobbing against that biblical verse, and they were arguing over text, sitting there learning Gemara. My father described these men as a vivid example of constructive revenge. By studying Jewish books, they were getting revenge against all those who had tried to destroy the people. They were reading the same words that the Nazis had burned in bonfires. They were dedicated to recovering what had been lost while improving their own lives. This is the most powerful form of revenge, my father said. Then someone came over to me and asked me if I would be counted for a minion. And we realized it was really getting tough and a little bit tight to stay there. But I wanted to leave a note, a prayer, in the Kotel, on the men's side, just in case. They had a more direct line up to God. And so quickly, I scribbled one word. I didn't have time. They were really starting to sort of murmur and buzz, and the Yentl thing was wearing thin. And people were kind of starting to look at me, so I wrote one word on a piece of paper, and I kissed it, and I tucked it into a crack on the men's side of the wall. So what was that one word? It was transformation. And what I mean by transformation is, don't deny the need to get even. We all have it. Just transform it into something positive, to transform either your enemy, if you're lucky enough, if you can. And if not, so let them hate, right? Let the anti-Semites hate. Use that transformative energy to transform yourself. That was my dream, from my mouth to God's ears. It was just a fantasy. A few months passed. The letters were going back and forth between me and the gunman. Yes, he said he was sorry. He said he would never perform any acts of violence again. For my father, who's very practical, for him, he felt like that was enough. Look, the guy had been in jail for 12 years now. As long as he promises never to hurt anyone, maybe that was enough. I wasn't so sure. Finally, I had my chance to meet him, to come face to face with him. He was in a medical hearing. He was suffering from very bad asthma. And so a panel of three judges was going to hear, actually just from his lawyer, about whether or not he should be released on medical grounds because his health was deteriorating in prison. So the day before I had my big chance to meet him, there's one other person I forgot to mention who didn't know anything about this, because why should she if you're doing something crazy? My mother, who's sitting there in green. The day before the hearing, my mom was visiting Israel, and I said, Mom, I got to tell you what I've really been doing this past year, because I know you thought I was researching a book, but there's a personal element. And I told her what I was doing, and she said, I'm going with you. So she came with me to the courtroom, and in walked the family. And I have to tell you, as a journalist, I never really take action, right? My job in life is to observe. But this was like the most important day of my life where I knew I had to act. And whatever I did that day would define who I was as a Jew, as a daughter, as a person. I was going to have to take a stand. I couldn't just take notes. I would have to make a decision. The shooter was a symbol to me. And you can pick your poison. He was a symbol to me of the Holocaust, of anti-Semitism, of, like I said, that kind of crouching shadow in an alley that when you're just walking along and think everything is okay could suddenly ambush you. I said to my mother, look, he's written me letters saying he'll never hurt anyone again and he's sorry. I want to believe him. I want to believe the world is good. Am I a fool? I want to believe the world is a good place. And my mother looked at me, she's from Kansas, so she's got that Midwestern optimism. And her face was so sad, but she said to me one of the most hopeful things I've ever heard, really. She said, sweetheart, and I choke up, she said, sweetheart, that's all we have in life, to believe that the world is good. And so I decided to take a chance that day in the courtroom, and there were no witnesses, nobody was allowed to speak. But I argued my way up to the front of the courtroom. The prosecutors were yelling, who is she? She has no right to speak. Let her sit down. The defense attorney also was telling me, you have no place here, the judges. Finally, I got permission to stand up and speak, but I wouldn't say who I was. I said, I'm anonymous. And so the judges let me stand up and speak. They were about to dismiss the case and send Omar back to prison. I stood up. I remember I was so nervous, actually. I was stood like this, my back completely, I don't know if any of you have back issues, but my back completely crimped up, and I said to the three judges, and my mother was sitting behind me, and Omar's family was all sitting there, and they had known me as Laura, the Christian who spoke Arabic and English, never spoke Hebrew, right? I wasn't a Jew. Omar shot some Jew. I was Laura, their friend, and I said, I want to speak in Hebrew. And at that point, Omar looked really, really worried. He was in handcuffs, and he said, who is she? What is this? And he started asking his lawyer, and she said, shh, 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 let her speak. And I said, my name is Laura. I come from the United States, and I don't know all the facts of this case, but I do know that Omar has served 12 years, and he says he'll never hurt anyone again, and he promises that he's never going to harm anybody. I also know the victim, and I've spoken to David. His name is David, and he says that 12 years is punishment, that's enough. And the judge says, sit down, who are you? You have no right to speak. And I was thinking in my mind, this is my moment for transformation. It's either going to work and I'm going to be a hero, or it's going to fail and I'm going to be a fool. Because by performing this radical act, an act of generosity, maybe I could transform my enemy, maybe I wouldn't. And I kept talking and I said, I do have a right to speak. And I moved my mother at that point to the back of the courtroom because I knew that any minute now things could get violent. I didn't want the family near her. I do have a right to speak. The judge says, sit down, you don't have a right to speak. And I said, yes, I am his daughter, David Blumenfeld. I am Laura Blumenfeld. And I just remember the judges kind of falling backward. And the judge said, one of them said, why did you do such a crazy and dangerous thing? I said, because I wanted them to understand we aren't military targets, that David Blumenfeld is a good man with a family, he's a person. And then I looked at Omar and I said, and you can't just kill us. And this is on, sorry, I'm looking at you. I said, this is on your honor. This is a vow now between your clan, the Khatibs, and my clan, the Blumenfelds, that you will never raise your hand in violence again. And I have to say, Omar, remember I told you about this fantasy of shaking him up? He looked shaken. He looked horrified. He looked shocked. And the judge said to him, well, when did you find out who she was? And he stood up. I can only say it in Hebrew because I remember him shouting with his chains. He said, Rak achshav, rak achshav, right now, rak achshav. He apologized to my mother. My mother was there. His mother was crying and reached out to my mother and said, we are two mothers, each with broken hearts. I took my mother and got out of there again. I wasn't sure. You never know with revenge, right? What will happen next? A few weeks later, I got a letter from Omar, and he said to me, Laura, you made me feel so stupid that I ever caused you and your kind family any pain. I'm sorry that I misunderstood your message from the beginning. And he wrote my father a letter, much more important, and he said, Laura was the mirror held up to your face to get me to see you as a human person. I finally understand the message for peace. So Omar wasn't released that day, but several years later he was released for good behavior. And as soon as he got out, he agreed to go back to the spot where my father was shot in the marketplace and pose. This was in the middle of the second intifada when there was terrible violence between the Israelis and Palestinians, really attacking and killing Israelis. But he stood in that spot, and the headline is, Mitzta'er she'yariti b'cha, Mar Blumenfeld. I'm sorry I shot you, Mr. Blumenfeld. 17 years after he tried to murder a Jew in the Old City, Omar Khatib is released from prison. In his first interview, he talks about how hate, I'm just translating from the Hebrew, is turned into friendship, and how he met the daughter and the family, and how she testified on his behalf and showed him the way how to believe in the ways of peace and humanity. So what is the best revenge? Well, Dad, you're right. Constructive revenge is the best revenge. You know, they say don't get mad, get even. What I would say the Jewish way is don't get even better. So what can you take home from this today? My father's revenge, once a year he goes to Israel, he gets a big plate of hummus, he eats it with his grandchildren, and he says, I'm coming back. Shoot me in the head, I'm back. 30 years later, that's constructive revenge. For you, it might be once a month. The hate, the extremism, anti-Semitism, and terrorism is out there, but you're going to go to a Jewish lecture once a month. Or maybe once a week, you're going to practice your Judaism by visiting a sick person, right? Bikur Cholim, or somebody, or a Shiva call. Or maybe you'll celebrate something, a bris, something happy. Or it could be every night, really quietly alone in your bed, to say that simple Shema before you go to sleep. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. That connects you like a chain all the way back to Moshe. And you can say, as Rabbi Resnick told us earlier when he was referring to the Ten Commandments, anti-Semites, he here I am. That is the best revenge. Because what we've been taught by our rabbis is against the darkness, we must retaliate with light. And that is the Jewish way. Thank you. Shabbat Shalom.